The word only sounds scary to me, unsecured credit.
So you talk about timing and I agree with you, but if you look at the secular trend.
Bets both on the consumer side as well as the SME side. So we're very excited about some of those investments that we made.
We have both under-penetration as well as, you know, strong GDP growth, which is now getting democratized across.
Such that we can find great investing opportunities today.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode. I have with me Vikram Vaidyanathan. Vikram and I cover fintech and financial services. Today's episode is on unsecured credit. So Vikram, unsecured credit has been the buzzword for the last 12 months in the fintech FS circles. Is that good, bad? I know we have stayed away from it for some time till recently.
The word only sounds scary to me, unsecured credit. I think it's a very traditional view that unsecured credit has been very hard to do, and I think it has been very hard to do. As a VC or founder, you know, the hardest part is to get timing exactly right, and you never get it exactly right. You're either too early or you're too late, and sometimes you get lucky and you get it exactly right. But most of the time, you're too early or too late. I think we've been watching the space very closely. So we are highly interested participants. In that first wave of digital consumer credit companies, we came close to doing maybe or investing in maybe one company. And I think that one company is likely to be a miss. So if I look at that, you know, it might be that we've missed it. But the good thing about lending and financial services is you get multiple opportunities at goal. I think today I find that this environment is much more stable, risk-adjusted, such that we can find great investing opportunities today. So I'm very bullish at the point that we are. I know we've made a bunch of unsecured credit bets, both on the consumer side as well as the SME side. So we're very excited about some of those investments that we've made.
So you talk about timing, and I agree with you. But if you look at the secular trend, I mean, you know, if you look at credit penetration in India, it's probably still... we grew at, what, 7% as a GDP. Nominal credit growth is normally 1.5-2 times banking and financial services and credit. We have both under-penetration as well as, you know, strong GDP growth, which is now getting democratized across different regions. So we sort of have multiple tailwinds coming together. I agree with you, both SME and consumer, there's a wide credit gap across both these segments. If you look at household credit, if you look at business credit, the number of SMEs that are now sort of coming in, I think we have 60 million SMEs. Now with GST coming in, a lot of their data gets coming into the system, making it easier for us to underwrite them. So you talked about timing. In this secular backdrop, do you think we should have a more nuanced view on why certain segments of unsecured credit is booming and how do we play some of these, you know, versus consumption, and the various ways to look at it?
Yeah, so let's just talk about that first wave. And, you know, one of the thing that was most exciting about the first wave was that it was digital, right? So you could certainly source borrowers digitally and you could theoretically underwrite borrowers digitally. And the reason I'm saying it's theoretically underwrite borrowers is that there was a lot of alternate data company, and this is before your time, but everybody was
SIM marketing, data, phone data.
Right? So there was all this alternate data that was, you know, leading to lookalike models, which means that this person looks like Anish, so must be as creditworthy as Anish type lookalike models, which didn't work. But you couldn't actually figure out actual underwriter, what can you pay, right? What do you earn? How do you spend? And therefore, what can you pay every month? And therefore, what kind of product can I offer? And therefore, most of the products were, because you have a thin file, I say, okay, I can't underwrite a lot of risk. You as in the borrower has a thin file. I can't underwrite a lot of risk. And therefore, let me figure out a thin file product. Short term, high interest rates, small ticket, right? So you're trying to limit the risk basis the information that you have. And those products essentially didn't end up being satisfactory. People either got hooked onto it. So you're saying, I need this credit every month. Or, you know, I need it for a more long-term objective. And I can pay this money out over the long term. So I need a 1 year loan or I need a 2 year loan. And therefore the short term didn't actually fit their lives. What has changed? What has changed is the data is now real, which means that because of this explosion of UPI, because of AA, I can actually triangulate, you know, your incoming salary as well as your outgoing spend. I also know what categories you spend. I also know what is your pattern of spending, such that I can actually construct what your life and lifestyle and in terms of financial lifestyle is pretty much down to the T. So that means that I can actually underwrite fully and therefore then tailor the right products. I can tailor the right loan size. I can tailor the right tenure. And actually, I like the fact that these interest rates are now in not usurious territory, right? Not money lender territory, but it is, you know, 14-15% at the low end, going up to 24% at the high end for SMEs and so on. But it's not that I have to charge 4-5% per month in order for, or an IRR basis for this to work. And therefore, real data, right products. Then I think the fraud and identity stack has just become real. Because with a country like ours, the largest problem is you are who you say you are and this is your data. Right? If you can, that in itself, I think could take out 10-20% of the bad loans that come through, and then you build the credit, rest of the credit costs into the business model.
And even within unsecured, and that makes a lot of sense in terms of, you know, now there is CIBIL plus plus underwriting where you use a lot of other information along with CIBIL, and I'll come to how we are seeing some of that playing out in MSME. But we're also seeing that at each customer segment, at each ticket size, at each APR, there are about 1 to 5 million borrowers. And you've always made that point that, you know, if you capture 500K to a million in that, you can build a pretty large...
More on that, 500K to a million.
So, you know, basically you're saying, so let's say you take a cut off, there is a certain set of people, for example, home improvement loans, right? So there are a lot of people in tier 2-3 cities who have either medical emergencies or home improvement activities that come up once a decade or once in 5 years. Or there is, let's say, a large one-time higher education expense. These are essentially high-quality borrowers or, you know, well, not super prime, but close to prime or near-prime borrowers who have the right credit culture, who have the right salary to pay for, who've had vintage, who've been living in the same area, but they've not been traditionally served by banks or been underserved by banks and NBFCs, either in terms of TAT or what ticket size of loan they can get for how long. And today, there are a host of NBFCs and fintechs who are trying to cater to these segments. The reason I say 1 to 5 is basically, you are if you are able to find these borrowers and you are able to establish the intent, and if you are able to say that the end use of the loan is actually a cash flow mismatch or is it, it's a productive use, for example, home improvement, or if it's, for example, an MSME into putting in, into your inventory financing or business, then there is some end use established that it's a productive asset. So putting all this together, if you're able to get to those 500 to a million, I think you can build a 4,000-5,000
I think you made 2-3 points that we discussed a lot. One is that you don't need a very large base of borrowers in order to build a large company. And we have this thumb rule that, you know, 500 to a million borrowers can actually lead to at least a billion, if not 2-3 billion of market cap. And, you know, we have many companies empirically, Five-Star, Aptus, a bunch of them who have ended up there. And, you know, there is loan size, tenure, it's a little bit of a complicated math. But roughly, if you take the early companies, even the thing, even the companies that became very large banks, whether it is AU or IDFC and so on, ended up at roughly a million borrowers early or a million accounts early. And that actually then got their journey started. So can you get to that first base? So that's one thing that he said. Second is figuring out what is that right use case and then use case backwards, designing some of those products. And then the third is the consumer segment and really understanding that consumer segment. We have a company, we'll bleep this name out if we haven't announced it by then, but it's called And that company underwrites very stable, medium income borrowers, but with low income mobility. So think of person working in an IT company in tier 2, tier 3, very stable. Their income is not going to grow very much. Their family has lived there in that small town forever, so not going anywhere. So that's actually a very good borrower. It's you just have to right-size the loan, right-size the tenure, and you can actually, and they are not getting access to, you know, the kind of financial services that same IT person would get in the city, but you can actually underwrite them. Or a very stable bank employee of a, call it a tier two bank, even they are not getting access
which
to loans.
Which is very surprising. In some of our customer research, we heard that there are NBFC and bank employees who are not getting underwritten by their own organizations or by other banks and NBFCs. And banks all the time keep talking about ETB and cross-sell and, you know, salary account customers getting loans. Yeah. That was a surprising finding for us.
Yeah. So really doing consumer backwards and then saying use case, consumer backwards, I think you actually can design very interesting products.
So you mentioned 500K to 1 million borrowers. How do you get to them? You know, today, the first wave of companies probably would largely do Facebook digital marketing, would probably have an app where you would come and download the app and sort of get a loan. You would have a low and grow loan, which sort of over a period of time grows the borrower. Are we seeing a lot more phygital GTMs in the companies? I know we've invested in a couple. How do you get to these borrowers and what's working well both on consumer and MSME?
So we've now moved to sort of, first we talked about product design, now we're talking about sourcing and how do you source borrowers in this. And one of the things we realized as we looked at a lot of digital first sourcing companies in the lending space is that digital CAC was much higher than offline CAC. You were getting to a subsized loan. So if offline CAC is lower and you're getting to a larger loan, then that business model is much superior to digital CAC being higher and you're getting to a give us smaller size loan.
So I have some data on this. One of our portfolio companies, so we have the physical channel is giving 8x high, physical or phygital channel gives 8x higher approval rate. So the online channel is 2%, the phygital is about 16%, with 1.5 to 2 times higher credit loss on the stat pool. I think it seems that not all digital channels...
That's crazy, right? So that's a 12x move overall if you compare physical to digital channel. And just demystifying this, because even though that the phygital channel, the offline person going out and sourcing might actually be more expensive than putting out the ad. But if they are first, there is some intuition, they pick up certain files, they don't pick up other files, then the conversion rate of those files is higher, which is what you said. The conversion funnel, it's 8x more. And then because they have done some level of intuitive credit underwriting from that channel, or they have essentially collected more data, the approval rates are higher. And therefore, even if the approval rates are higher, the credit loss is lower. So overall, it's just become a much more superior channel. And so almost all the companies that we've invested in, which are sort of the new breed of companies, which are tech-led NBFCs is the way I would call them. The hallmark has been phygital sourcing. And they just use the digital handoff at exactly the right time where they're sourcing offline. They could be, sourcing through DSAs. And I can't believe I'm saying that there's a company that's sourcing through DSAs that we have actually, we are very excited about.
Managed DSA.
Managed DSA. Managed DSA models that we are very excited about. Because they have done the offline to online handoff beautifully, such that they own the customer. And then they are actually managing a digital funnel, anybody else would. Or we have another company, which is Seedsfin Cap, where they have a very large offline workforce, but each of them has a LOS app, which is just probably the best app that we've seen in terms of design. And it is all designed to prevent fraud at the point of origination. So we are just seeing all of these companies marry offline, online in a beautiful way. And I'm going to go to this next point, which is on right tech. And I know we're going to come to it later.
I was going to ask you that. What tech is right tech?
Because I think for all of these companies, we are also seeing that their tech budgets are far lower than the quote-unquote traditional fintech startup, right? Where you start building a lot of tech way in advance of the business. These companies have said, okay, in this offline-online journey, where can I use tech to either improve approval rate or give me operating leverage or prevent fraud and then say, okay, this is the right tech to identify. They've not said everything needs to be digital. This is the journey that I think I want to imagine, but the marketplace might not be ready for it. So I think nuanced consumer journeys, then figuring out where do I insert tech for the maximum advantage.
Yeah, no, I think we've been very clear, like if you're using tech, then it has to show up. And normally in the ones we have been looked at or come close to, it's shown up in some metric. Either it's shown up in better credit costs, better collection efficiency, or preventing field force frauds, operating costs being lower.
Or approval rates.
Or approval rates. Or even customer experience, the handoff point you spoke about. You've sourced the customer offline, but now you own the customer and sort of take the journey. Have you also seen you've been in this investing for 15 years, have you seen structurally any change in terms of why unsecured lending might be lucrative now, just in terms of the geographies you've seen newer players crop up in and the ease of operations that some of the NBFCs are seeing today versus what it would have been 15 years ago?
So traditionally, if you just take the last 20 years of NBFCs, there was a trend of south NBFCs, right, and which is the southern region of the country, and less NBFC penetration in the north and so on. Part of it was just the GDP of the southern states versus the northern states and so on. But second was also partly the behavior of the borrowers, but partly also the collections efficiency that you could do, that you could demonstrate in those states versus the northern states. I think some of that has completely changed because the northern states now, actually the projected GDP growth forward is higher. And so you will see much faster credit growth in those markets. But it's also coupled with better law and order in all of these states. And I know you came in with a pitch about a startup in a few of the northern states. And I immediately said no, because I had this bias that collections efficiency in those states is low, and then I don't want to invest in those states. And then you kept pushing, and I still didn't trust what you were saying. But I said, let me call one of old experienced founders in that space. So I called him and I asked him, you know, his name is Rajesh. Rajesh ji, kya change hua hai? And he immediately said that collections has changed because law and order has changed, road infrastructure has changed. And that immediately means that he can go further, and his collections people don't get beat up when they go and try to collect a loan and so on. And therefore, loan books have changed. And that's why I immediately started engaging with you on that startup pitch.
And there is lesser instances of cash collections now with UPI, India Stack.
That's a big deal. I'm glad that you brought it up. Go ahead.
No, so basically, traditionally, you know, you would have field force going out there, visiting customers' houses. I think some part of the secured companies still do it, where you go every month to the house, collect cash. And then there's a huge challenge in terms of reconciling that cash, bringing it back to the branch, closing the account on the same day. Because of this cash and multiple handoff points, it just gives you scope for a lot more frauds. And the OPEX cost is higher, yep. Reconciliation is harder. And you don't even know if the end cash is actually coming from the borrower or is there is evergreening from the sales force. All that is gone now with UPI, NACH mandates. I mean, most of the companies we are investing in today either have anywhere between 90 to 95% in digital collections. Even the one which is not digital is largely bounce, which they're trying to collect offline due to technical issues or, you know, some reason that the customer is not able to sort of pay online.
And traditionally, digital used to be 30, 40%. And we are talking about tier 2, tier 3, actually tier 4, tier 5 markets really. And it used to be 30, 40% at most. Then we had a big COVID boost where things went to 60, 70%. But now we're just routinely seeing companies which are at 90, 95%.
Yeah. No, I think that's another big tailwind, and I think over a period of time, I see most of them sort of going to 100, and there being very little cash collections. I think the last point I wanted to cover, I think there is some intent from the customer to sort of be both economically and socially upwardly mobile. For example, the MFI +++ customer who's now moving away from the joint liability group and has 5 years or 10 years.
It's a super interesting trend line, and you know, context we were. Early investors in Basics, we were in, for the first investor in Five Star. So we have a lot of context on these tier 3, tier 4 markets and the, you know, what kind of borrowers emerge. One complete aside is that there is a credit bureau called Highmark. And I'm not sure, it's like CIBIL, but it was created for all the microfinance companies to share that, share their credit data with them. And, you know, I remember looking at Highmark maybe in 2010. At that point of time, it was a small org. Now it has data of more than 100 million borrowers, if not more. And it has multiple cycles of those borrowers, of how they behaved in the JLG, joint liability group model in MFI. And suddenly you can pull out select borrowers from that model because they are now ready to be individual graduated. Credit borrowers, and they've graduated.
I think this was a great discussion. Thanks, Vikram. Thanks a lot for your time. Hope this was insightful.
Godspeed to our investments.